I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News, Holden Shepherd. Welcome back, Holden.
G'day, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's lovely to see you again. It's coming up 6 years since we chatted about your Hungerford Prize victory and your first novel, Invisible Boys, which was a great read, and we'll perhaps that'll feature in part in the discussion we're about to have. But you've had a second novel since we met. Tell our listeners what that was called.
Yeah, so after Invisible Boys came out with Fremantle Press in 2019, I had a second novel called The Brink, which is a thriller / contemporary young adult fiction. It was published by Text Publishing in 2022. That one is about a group of high school leavers who head up on their Leavers Week trip to a kind of fictional wedge island, remote island, very secluded, and someone drops dead in the middle of their leavers party.
Say no more.
Yep. Immediately everyone's under suspicion, everyone has a motive. It's a bit of a locked room mystery, kind of Agatha Christie style, devolves a little bit like Lord of the Flies in the modern day version. So that's The Brink, and it again, like Invisible Boys, although it's plot, you know, it's got some plotty action stuff happening, it is based on the characters and it's based on their emotional interior lives.
Well, you're clearly a person who writes about gay people in your novels. And people won't be surprised to find there are themes in both these books.
Yes, absolutely.
And you've got another novel, I gather, on the way.
I do. So we just announced recently that my third novel, Two Kings, will be published by Pantera Press in June 2025. That book is my first novel for adults. So as much as Invisible Boys and The Brink are widely read by adults, probably more than young adults, this is my very first one that's squarely marketed at an adult audience. It's about a 36-year-old labourer named Jack, and he's returning home to Geraldton after many years away and facing his demons, facing his family.
Well, it's good to hear that Gero is still in the thick of things.
My brain hasn't quite worked out that I've left. I've been in Perth for a long time. But
well, I thought you were going to tell me it started with Invisible Boys in Geraldton, got to Wedge Island, and you've made it to near the outskirts of Perth.
And then circled right back, yes.
So I think, Holden, that your books have been getting very good critical review. Tell our listeners a little bit about recent shortlists that you're on.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy that the Brink, I mean, Invisible Boys picked up a lot of awards. It picked up the WA Premier's Prize, shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Awards, obviously got the Hungerford and lots of others. It's done really well, that book. It's punched above its weight. The Brink was my second baby. I was not sure if it would get any acclaim. I thought it was maybe a little bit more commercial and would be more salesy, but not necessarily be seen as acclaimed literature. I was wrong. It's done very nicely.
Happily wrong.
Very happily wrong. It's done very nicely, The Brink. So it won the 2024 Ina Noel Award. It's won the 2023 Indie Book Awards Young Adult Book of the Year. And it's just been shortlisted for the South Australian Premier's Literary Awards, which has just I've just found out as we do this interview, would you believe?
Like breaking news, minutes folks.
Minutes before. It's very exciting.
Congratulations. Look, you write with vitality and a style that really is lovely to read. If people haven't been reading you, go out and get Holden Shepherd. Start in any order. Often at the beginning is a good place to start. Now, all of this acclaim and recognition of your writing ability has taken you recently to serve on a panel talking about censorship of books, public libraries, what's allowed on shelves and what's not allowed on shelves. What was that all about?
Yeah, so it was Library and Information Week, and the theme, I believe, was the roots of democracy, which was holding up books and libraries and free access to information and literature as a cornerstone, a key pillar of democracy and what we stand for. You need to be able to access all points of view. We have to tolerate different views, different cultures. That's what makes a democratic society function. So the theme of this panel was the freedom to read. And we were talking about, from a few different angles, how important this tolerance is. From the point of view of myself as an author, there was a sociologist and academic on the panel. There was someone there from Public Libraries WA, who's a librarian. and it was chaired by Georgia Richter, who is the very esteemed publisher at Fremantle Press of their adult list. So we had a really robust discussion, very engaged audience. My sense is that most people in Australia, most people in a democracy, understand the need to have very different perspectives on the shelves. And I certainly understand it. You know, as a gay man, I certainly want my books to be out there for people who need them. And I also understand that with my request for tolerance of what I'm all about, I must then tolerate, you know, if someone wants to put a book on the shelf that says, you know, traditional families, values, whatever they want to say, that's fine. I can survive that. They can survive my book as well. So we can coexist in that way. And I think that's a very important cornerstone of a harmonious society.
It sort of raises the whole spectre, doesn't it, of book banning, book burning, and all of the sort of incidents we know about over time. I mean, there was a point in the US, probably other parts of the world, where people weren't allowed to teach evolution theory in schools, and the idea that God created the world 5,000 years ago and humans fully formed landed on it, apparently in some southern American states, was the only permissible view. And you wouldn't be able to write about anything different. You wouldn't be able to put that book on the local library shelf because it would pollute the minds of these young people. And I suppose you look at other examples. Tell me if they came up in the seminar. But we live in an age, unfortunately, where we see terrorism. We see, whether you call it terrorism or not, mass murders in different parts of the world. And I suppose if someone wrote a book telling you how to make your own bomb and how most easily to drop it and how to kill the most number of people in the shortest period of time in Australia, we hope that doesn't appear on a library shelf.
Well, that's right. I think the fun part, sometimes tedious, depends on who's raising it, but the fun part when it's part of an intellectual free discussion is what are the limits on free speech, free press, free expression? And people tend to land around where you have, which is, you know, if someone's wanting to write an instruction manual on how to cause harm or physically hurt people or hate people or incite hate or violence, that's not okay. You know, it's about the whole, you can't step into a theatre and yell fire. You know, that's going to cause damage and destruction. So I think everyone from any political bent recognises that some limits to speech are required. We can't function in a society without some of those. Generally, I think people then land somewhere on a spectrum of how far is enough, how far is too permissive, how far is okay. And lately, it's books like mine, so books containing gay characters, gender diverse characters, anything LGBT basically, in the US has been very challenged and banned and things like that.
So let's just explore that for a moment.
Yeah.
Why is it, as you see it, that some people, some organisations, basically want to ban those books, perhaps the books you've written? What is it that frightens them or concerns them or is devaluing or whatever in their mind?
Yeah, I think it's often couched in language around, you know, what about the children? And we've got to save the children from the spectre of this evil homosexuality that, you know, has suddenly entered their domain, because it might be on a shelf in the school library on a pride shelf, or it might be in a local bookshop and there might be a local pride festival or book festival or something, you know. And this sometimes concerns people. I think as well there is a sense that anything LGBT is in some way adult, that it has to be 18 plus, you know, which, I mean, gay teenagers exist. I existed. I can tell you for sure that I existed and I'm a real person, and so are millions and millions of other people like me, gay men and lesbians, and there's bisexual women and women, trans people, non-binary people. We exist. And so these books are just about our experience. Certainly something like Invisible Boys, I didn't have that, right? I was reading the Bible. I was a good Catholic schoolboy. I was reading the Bible. That didn't stop me from being who I am. I didn't have Invisible Boys on my shelf, so nothing turned me the way I am. It's just how I am. It's just what happened. And so I think we need to kind of get around that thought of, oh, these books being on the shelf might influence my child. They really won't. Like, you know, my book being on the shelf in a school, I've spoken to many schools, many of those straight students, none of them have turned gay. You know, like, it's absolutely fine. What it does do is it builds empathy for, you know, people who haven't experienced this, realize a bit of what we go through, and they just kind of get a little bit more like, okay, that sounds really hard. You know, I don't want to make your life worse. I think it's a good thing when books and stories build empathy for marginalized people and people from different backgrounds.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that it seems that there's this great pressure in society for everyone to conform.
Mm.
Although there are so many exceptions to the rule, but when it comes to sexual orientation, people seem to get very sturdy and frightened or militant or whatever it is, and it brings, it seems, the worst out in us very often.
Yeah, there's a moralizing to it, which I fully understand. You know, having come from a Catholic upbringing where it was kind of, I had year 12 RA teachers kind of going, you know, this is terrible, it turns my stomach, it makes me sick, the thought of homosexuality, and I'm sitting there as a, you know, 16-year-old,
gosh,
looking up going, I hope no one knows what's going on with me.
Yeah.
You know, am I sick? Am I evil? You know, that's not nice to hear. That leads directly to terrible mental health. I mean, that's what I had and that's what I dealt with. So when I write my stories, when other people like me write their stories, we're just telling the world, this is my experience. This is how it feels to be me. I want you to know. Some people who've been like me read Invisible Boys, read The Brink, and they feel incredibly seen. I get fan mail about those books still every week, sometimes daily, sometimes weekly.
Mm.
But from gay men from the age of about 16, 17, but mostly up into their 70s and 80s.
You've helped people.
People say, this is me.
Yeah.
They'll point to one of the characters and say, this is what I went through back in, you know, whatever town in Queensland, Tasmania, somewhere in England, somewhere in the United States. They'll say, this was me in that decade. The feelings are exactly the same. The shame, the self-loathing, it's the same. It doesn't change. And they go, thank you, it's helped me process this trauma I didn't even know I was hanging on to. That's huge. That's huge for a book to do.
People who, in our society, are marginalised for whatever reason, get spoken about badly. Just describe how a teacher might speak about a topic like homosexuality.
Mm.
I mean, it's a form of hate speech, what you just said, really.
I guess you're probably right. I think, you know, there's so much I faced growing up that I didn't categorise it in those ways. I didn't even know what hate speech was, really. You do cop a lot of that. You know, I copped a lot of opinions and a lot of people's views, and you learn very quickly to try to survive that and not talk about it too much.
Well, we've got this huge sort of cultural revolution which Australia's been going through, at least since the Europeans arrived and brought their culture in Western Australia, not even 200 years ago. And people write about cultural history and it keeps moving.
Mm.
And what one might call the broad gay movement, which I'm not sure when one dates it from intellectually, but I'm thinking of my cousin. And the 70s and 80s were certainly big periods. And you talked about gay pride and marching at the Mardi Gras in Sydney. Suddenly there's a movement.
Yeah.
I mean, the Jews, very large ethnic and powerful group of people, were able to respond to anti-Semitism, apart from anything else, through numbers and being able to marginalise. And so you've got these political movements which are designed to protect interests, and I guess it's an ongoing thing, but when it comes to public libraries and public discussion, have the libraries ever caved in? Have they taken sex manuals, even sex manuals, off the shelves for fear of the kids learning, let alone a book like Invisible Boys?
Yeah, so I'm lucky that, so there's two things I'd love to answer that with.
Yes.
One of them is, I guess, about my own experience, which I won't go too much into, but, you know, there have been attempts by people to kind of write to libraries or write to high school principals and basically try to say, you know, this book, Invisible Boys, is evil, you know, get it out of the libraries. And I'm very heartened by librarians as a profession in Australia and overseas. These very hardworking people who very much uphold, I mean, I don't want to get too high-minded about it, but they are upholding the roots of democracy here by saying, no, this is allowed and we want to defend the right to have these books. So that I did have, you know, someone try to campaign to get my book thrown out of certain libraries and certain schools. To my knowledge, all
here,
of those
here
libraries,
in Western Australia?
Here in WA, yes.
Oh, for goodness
yes,
sake.
This was in 2022.
Oh,
which is
goodness.
3 years after the book came out, which, you know, if I was expecting pushback, it would have been near the start of the book being released. It happened 3 years later because there is, simultaneously, there is a trend in the US for groups like this, for conservative religious groups to lobby to challenge or ban books, especially in the high school space. And so that's been happening the last few years. We've imported that. It's the worst thing we could have imported from the US, or one of the worst things we could have imported. And people have started to do it here about 2 years ago. So my book got targeted. I didn't talk about it on social media. I didn't kick up a fuss about it and make it my whole brand or personality. I trusted that the librarians would defend it, and they did. You know, it's still in school libraries. It's still being read by year 11s and 12s. It's on the curriculum. It's studied at university curricula. So that book has been defended. Librarians do it very well. Sometimes there's a situation where the lobbyists will go to the city council, which is what happened a couple of months ago in New South Wales. So there was the Cumberland Council situation with a book about same-sex parenting. And that did, I think, I'm going to say 1 week or 2 weeks. It was short-lived. But because of a council resolution, it was taken off the shelves, or it was forced to be not allowed. Thankfully, that got overturned. But that took a huge amount of community kind of backlash and speaking up to say, you know, this is Australia. We don't ban books here. We tolerate. You know, I think that's an Aussie trait. I think it's an Aussie value. I think it's very much worth defending. We should tolerate people who are different to us. That means there's going to be things on the shelf or walking down the street that me personally, I might not necessarily like. A religious person who's conservative might not necessarily like. But in the interests of everyone being free and everyone getting along, we must tolerate it. That's my view. And I think that's a better way forward than trying to shut down or silence or ban people. Or, you know, anyone who bans books historically isn't the good guys.
No, but when you're frightened of ideas, then you're frightened of life, and you're probably very frightened of yourself, or fearful in some strange way.
Hmm.
When you go into a library, or when I wander down here in the Western to Fremantle to New Edition, a great Fremantle bookshop, one of those that still continues to
yes.
exist, I'll see labels, history, new novels, probably yours in there, you know, self-therapies or
yep.
whatever the categories are, children's literature, young adult literature.
Mm.
Which provide guidance, but is there some sort of responsibility on bookshops or libraries to provide something that might be called a more than just guidance, but even a warning to say you are about to read coming of age gay fiction here.
Yeah, this is a Holden Shepherd book. Beware. Funnily enough, yes. To my knowledge, my book is one of the only ones in Australia that's had this. But because Invisible Boys did pick up lots of accolades, it won a few things in the kind of children's and YA space. Now, my book is upper YA. It's very, very firmly pitched at 15 and over because it does have mature themes. There is some graphic content. You don't want that going to someone really who's too young to handle it. So it's very clearly pitched that way. But because of those exact categories that you speak of, sometimes people look at young adult, and instead of lumping that in with a broader adult or mature readership, it'll get lumped in with children's literature, which can sometimes lead to it sitting on a shelf where, you know, it is in front of the wrong people. So what my publisher, Fremantle Press, actually had to end up doing, especially when Invisible Boys got into much wider distribution. So when it picked up a few things, it ended up in places like Big W, in discount department stores, right? Where there's no bookseller, you know, discussing the purchase with you. And so it was easily, you know, could be picked up by anyone off the shelf in some way. We ended up putting a sticker, a warning sticker, on the back of Invisible Boys.
I didn't know that.
I haven't spoken much about it, but it it literally now says, and this is for years now, it's been on there, for mature readers 15 plus. So if you pick that book up, you can't possibly go to the counter and get it without realizing this is a mature book. Now, they don't do that with adult books. Adult, you know, contemporary fiction for adults does not have that sticker on it. It's because there is such a panic around this space that they want to be absolutely certain. And to some extent, you know, after it came up as an idea and it needed to happen, there was a part of me that was kind of like, well, that's not the worst thing, because I don't want it going, you know, I don't want it falling into the wrong hands of someone who is too young to read it. I mean, my view is that if you're too young to read it, you'd probably go, this isn't for me, and you'd put it down and you wouldn't read it. I don't think it hurts to have an extra layer of protection for everyone to make sure that, you know, no one's reading this who's too young. You know, it is mature.
Holden, I think it's just a brilliant marketing device.
Do you think? Well, it's like they used to do with CDs when CDs were more of a thing. But, you know, it was like a, you know, graphic content, parental advisory required.
So I want that.
It makes it more gangster. It's more street. So maybe it is good marketing.
Well, in Woolies or somewhere, it's on the bookshelf with all these other things. Good cakes to cook at Christmas, and there's yours with mature content 15
good
plus.
Good cakes to cook. yeah. I mean, it's just such a stark, you know, like, you don't want someone to pick this up thinking it's a fun book for, you know, an adventure novel or something.
One gets that. I mean, I think certainly reviewers of books try to convey to their readers just what this book is about and what you're getting into. Mm. And I suppose there are, you know, I've gone along to movies. I've walked out of a couple of movies in my life just because it was far too violent in each case.
Mm.
But sometimes you go to a movie, I think it's a better illustration, and you had no idea what it's about, and you're taken by surprise. So it is good to have something which indicates what the book's about.
Yeah, I don't think it's bad. I'm usually the book jacket, you know, the marketing, the blurb, that would be enough of a context clue, but we went the extra mile and made sure.
Yeah. It's an interesting topic when it comes to writers. I mean, we've sort of got down to a discussion in recent times. Can a male writer seek to portray the views of a woman character in his book? I suppose he can, but if he does it badly, he'll be pilloried for it.
Well, yeah.
and what about straight writers writing with gay characters? Does that happen?
Oh, it happens a lot. I've certainly got views on this, and I've said I've made them public many times.
Yes.
In my view, I mean, first of all, if you're writing fiction, I am old school humanist, secular, believing in as much creative freedom as possible. So ultimately, my cornerstone is, if you're writing fiction, you're going to be writing outside your experience in some way. I think the onus is on the author to do a good job of that. So if I write outside of, you know, a man from Geraldton or a gay man or whatever I am, then I think it's on me to do some research, to maybe run it past someone from that background and say, does this check out? You know, like, I don't particularly love the term sensitivity reader. Authenticity reader is not a bad term to me, because that's really my job as a researcher, as a writer, as an artist, is to say, look, I've done this thing, I've written outside my experience. The last thing I want is for it to be completely wrong or be offensive or be horribly, you know, misrepresenting something. So I'm going to run it past someone who's been in that space and just say, is this good or am I wrong, you know? And I've had a couple of people do that to me, and I saw the value in it, you know, people who've written gay characters, and they said, look, can you just look at this passage? And I could go, yeah, that's cool. Wow, that would never happen. You know, and you're picking it up and you're saying, look, I can tell you now this would never happen. And they're grateful because they can then take it out of their manuscript. So there is value in that. It does get over-policed though. And so I'm always cautious to kind of say that really, you know, if it's well done, if it's sensitively done, I think people can write outside their experience. But sometimes it happens, you know, way too much. If you look at the best-selling, what's called gay fiction, if you look at the best-selling stuff that is billed as, you know, there's titles out there that are multi-million selling fiction books. They're written by straight women for a straight female audience, and they treat gay men as sort of cute little puppies. And, you know, I don't particularly like it, but I also believe that, well, if I've got the right to write a straight male character or a straight female character, then a straight female author has the right to write a gay love story if she wants to. And I might sit there and say, I don't really like how it's done, but that's my right in a democracy to say, I don't particularly like the way that story depicts gay men. It doesn't mean I want to cancel that person. It doesn't mean I want her book to be pulped. It doesn't mean I think, get her out of the industry. I think we have overblown reactions sometimes to those things where I think I can just sit there and say, God, I can't stand that book. And I think that's okay, you know?
Well, there's a big market out there, and on that approach that you've just espoused, it's clear that that woman writer is writing for her very particular audience, and she knows what
Who love it. And
that's
they buy
what,
it.
That's what they want.
That's right.
They're not overly concerned about the gay puppy dog.
No.
But there's a lot going on in the story.
That's right. And so in a democracy and in a free society, I have to tolerate that. I believe that's my right. I also often make the point, though, that if, you know, there is a legion of, you know, straight women in their 40s and 50s writing about teenage gay boys. And I think if the reverse happened, if you had a legion of 40 and 50-year-old straight men writing about teenage lesbians, I don't think that would be received in the same way. I think that would be seen as really unusual. So I just think that's always a really fascinating counterpoint to say, isn't it odd that we really tolerate this in that way, but the reverse would be really horrific. You know, it wouldn't get published.
Well, the really tough ones are when some writers seem to have assumed an identity, an ethnic identity, which they don't have. That's taking things to an extreme, I suppose.
I mean, that would be, you know, I even believing in general terms that as a fiction novelist, I can write outside my experience. I don't see myself ever doing something where I go, let me write a book about a culture I know nothing about. You know, I've had characters who are from different cultures, but their story is not about that side of their life. I would never be able to speak authoritatively to that, and I would never want to walk in that space.
So I guess all of this brings us to a more general discussion about what literature, what all of these creative arts, theatric performance plays, movies, screenplays that support them, books, poetry, short stories, everything is about it. To me, it just strikes me that it reflects the society that we live in and as it changes and develops. Mm. And you expect to find all of these different writers coming from different vantage points. I mean, who do you think you're writing for? Do you think about that when you start a book?
That's a good question. I don't... This is not meant to sound dismissive of a readership or an audience because I need them. I need people to read my books. But I don't go into writing a book. When I look at my third book that I've just finished, Two Kings, or the fourth book that I'm currently writing, I'm editing my fourth book, which is a sequel to Invisible Boys, I don't go in thinking, what does my audience want? How would this be received? If I did that, I would produce terrible art or I would make very cynical art. I don't do that. I write for me. It is an incredibly selfish process, at least speaking for how I write. It's about what needs to be expressed, what do I want to say, what makes me happy to talk about. And that's, you know, and what hurts, you know, my books are driven from some little kernel of pain that I want to talk about this thing that hurt, you know, and everything blows up from there. So that's what I start with. I'm not thinking about, you know, is this appropriate for a 14-year-old or an 18-year-old or a 50-year-old? I don't think about that. I don't think about how a certain market will read it. But that does then start to come in, especially in this era where the world is hyper-political, hyper-polarized, hyper-outraged often. You know, the reaction to something in a book that might be objectionable slightly doesn't tend to be slight outrage. It tends to be nuclear outrage to anything. So when you are a creator in a climate and an ecology like that, which we are in the 2020s, you know, that's what it's like. When you get to the editing stage is when you start to think about, oh, if we keep that line in, what are people going to say? You know, do we need to cut that line? Do we need to change that line? Do we need to modify it? My publisher at Pantera Press for Two Kings said, you know, we're discussing a couple of lines this last week about, you know, if you want to have this line in, you know, is it in the context of the book? Do you want to go there? Do you want to back it in? Does it need to be challenged by another character? Those are the kind of conversations that editors will have now with authors to make sure that, well, to try to kind of make sure that your book doesn't become the next one that gets targeted on Twitter or TikTok or, you know, people trying to demand that the publisher pulps it, you know?
Well, that's the sort of the unintended consequence. You have a good editor, they say, do you mean this? Do you mean it to be there? And have you got the balance right in your book, I suppose?
That's right.
But it's lovely that artists generally, you included, write in that sense for yourself. But it's complete artistic freedom. Mm. And you write, and these books of yours are getting wonderful responses. And you'll have now, and you'll, I dare say, continue to have a growing audience. People say, Holden Shepherd's got a new book out.
Mm.
Must read that.
Mm.
Do you think you already have, or that you're likely to want to, in one sense, disappoint them by throwing them completely off guard, writing a complete straight novel, or whatever it might be that throws them off guard?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have lots of ideas of what my next books are. I mean, the first two are already published. The third one comes out next year. The fourth one is written. It's on the second, third draft, in between kind of phase at the moment. So I know where I'm going. I had a very interesting conversation with my husband, who's also a writer, last night. We were discussing the fourth book, and I was kind of saying, you know, the things I'm talking about in this fourth book, I said, I don't want to have a career. I'm not interested in a career as an author if I can't write this fourth book. Because if I have to hold back, if I have to write a fourth book, if I have to write a sequel to Invisible Boys that pulls all its punches and only says what is palatable and only says what I'm absolutely sure will be super, super safe and clean, I hang up my pen and my laptop. I wouldn't be interested in a career that does that. To me, it's not worth being an artist, being a punk, being expressive, if your output isn't allowed to actually say what you think. And I'm not talking about going out there and deliberately offending people either. That's not fun. That's not nice. But I'm talking about you need to me, as the kind of author I am, authors, artists need to be able to go to places that other people can't go in the public discourse. They need to say things and express things that are risky or honest or true or shine a light on dark things that people don't like to talk about. I think that's so important to what I do. So if I were to, you know, yeah, I wouldn't want to write that fourth book or any future book in a way where I'm told, oh, you have to stay away from that topic or you have to stay away from that theme. I would lose interest in doing this. You know, I'd go get a trade and become a mechanic or a carpenter, one of the two.
Well, the Greeks, I think, must have got into this puzzle as well when they solved it by saying, be true to yourself and you can't be false to any other person.
Oh, I love that.
It's a beautiful saying. I mean, you can put it into the more middle English form of English, but it is a beautiful thing. You have to be true to yourself.
I really love that. I think authenticity is just vital for life. If you're going to have a happy life, you need to be able to show up authentically. I'm not even talking as a performing, you know, author as an artist on stages. I just mean interpersonally.
Human being.
You need to be able to kind of show up and be like, well, this is what I'm like, and if people like me, that's wonderful, and if they don't, I will survive.
Well, it's wonderful to know, and our listeners will suddenly become instant Holden Shepherd fans if they aren't already, know that they can pick your books up and they'll get this honest account of what you're writing, which is you know, commendable and brings an extra strength to your brand, which brings us back to the whole question of people banning books or taking them off library shelves or having them under the counter and only giving them to people in brown paper bags or taking the scissors in and cutting certain passages out of them, page 322, paragraph 3 or something like that. Is there a fear that Australia is heading in that direction, the things we sometimes hear out of the US, which is meant to be the land of the brave and the free and the original creators of free speech?
I worry that we're susceptible to it. Like, we're definitely seeing a wave of this sort of behaviour coming in. Alison Oliver, who's from Public Libraries WA, was one of my fellow panellists at that event, and she was talking about, you know, this is new. This, to this extent, it hasn't happened before. And it's a situation where it's becoming like an health and safety issue for library staff because they're at the coalface and they're having people sort of barrel up to them and really go at them for how dare you have this on your shelves. Now, that behaviour has no place in Australia, in my view. You know, we shouldn't be doing that to anyone. I suppose the risk of this continuing to happen is that I think libraries are pretty good. I think city councils sometimes get skittish, and, which is why we saw what happened in Cumberland Council in New South Wales, where they kind of go, "Oh, we better do the, you know, we better not displease the voters." Mm-hmm. They to put it bluntly, they fucked around and they found out because you don't do that in a democracy. Mm-hmm. And the moment they tried to kind of save face with what they perceived might be a voting kind of issue, I think my understanding is, they found out very, very quickly from broader society that nobody wants this. You know, the percentage of people in Australia who want to ban or challenge any books is vanishingly small. They're very loud. They can barrel up to you with their camera phone on in a library and say, "How is this on your shelf?" And they can be outraged. But the number of people who actually believe that things ought to be banned is very tiny. Mm. So long term, I would hope we treat those people with as much, give them as much time as they deserve, which is none. I don't think that, you know, and often the complaints are not even genuine. You know, like it's someone who hasn't read the book often, who has a problem with the idea that they think the book represents, and they want to make sure that idea doesn't come anywhere near them.
It's always a telling question, isn't it, to say to somebody, "Have you actually read the book? Or have you seen the movie?"
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm pleased to tell you I read Portnoy's complaint at the time. It was banned here.
Oh, was it banned?
A friend brought it back from the UK, I think. It's fascinating. What are the subject matters currently, do you understand, that these pressure groups or individuals want to see taken from the public libraries?
The thing that seems to be happening definitely in the United States is it centres on a lot of marginalised experiences, so mostly LGBT content, so stuff around gay and lesbian people or stuff around trans and gender diverse people. There is a particular focus as well on, I haven't seen it so much here in Australia, but in the US, stuff around critical race theory, anything that's kind of talking about the concept of race and how systemic kind of inequality works and racism works, those books have been banned. To me, when you look at these banned book lists, it's kind of so telling. You know, like they're almost telling on themselves on how they feel about minorities. It's, you know, don't talk about that, which is, it kind of says to me that, you know, you realise you're the bad guy, right? You're trying to tell all these minorities to essentially shut up. It's not even about rights or policies. It's just about people telling their own life stories from these backgrounds and or telling made up fictional stories from these backgrounds. And they're being told, get out of the library. You know, we need you off the shelf. Shut up. We can't let people know what you go through. And it's just so wild. It's just wild.
Have others thought about how one responds to the, let's call it the threat of that sort of censorship? The fact that we're here talking about it is a response, and I think that's probably the number one response, isn't it? To name what's happening, to say, what's at risk here? What are we talking about?
Mm.
Don't we value free speech? Don't we enjoy a society that's got so many facets to it? Is anything required beyond that? Is there some form of regulation that's required?
I think some level of vigilance, like you know, identifying and naming these things when they happen is where we're at in terms of we need to be able to see it, we need to be aware of it, we need to call it out for what it is. The book bans often get called fascist, which they probably tend to be. I think it's maybe more all-encompassing to just kind of say anything authoritarian is something we don't want in the space of books and information. I don't want anyone from any political bent telling a library what they can have on the shelf. I don't think that's okay. Libraries are, I believe, looking at regulation around funding, so that I think it's something to do with the state government's funding them and making sure that a library essentially can't go and ban a book, because actually state government funding will require you to not ban books. So it's a protection that's kind of being looked at, being introduced to make sure that no individual library, like in Cumberland Council, can just kind of go, well, we're going to pull this book of same-sex marriage or same-sex parenting off our shelves. That's not going to happen in future. So I think as long as the society is always talking about how bad this is, I studied, you know, Germany between the wars, Nazi Germany, in Year 11 history, like many other students in Western Australia. We know what burning books and banning books does. I would lump into that category. It's not the same as banning books necessarily, but anyone who's going around kind of piling on or cancelling, you know, anyone and saying, look, their book has to be pulped, which there's been books in the US pulped because they were in some way very slightly potentially objectionable or offensive. To me, that's not that far removed from saying ban it from the library. If you're pulping a book or cancelling its release before it's even come out, I don't think we should be doing any of these things. I think we should be a permissive and tolerant society. If we don't like things, we have the amazing power to not read them. You know, how amazing. There are so many things I don't like. I don't read them. And I feel awesome. They don't trouble me in the slightest. I think that's a good way to go.
And I think it's a wonderful way to finish this lovely discussion, Holden.
It's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed getting into the nitty-gritty with you. Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers. We'll catch up with you before long.
I hope so. Cheers, mate.